This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. Who's Michael Phillips?
He's one of the guys who threw the film festival back in 19.
One of them bums from Chicago, kid. It's one of the Black Sox.
Old shoeless Michael Phillips, best film critic to play the game. How do you throw a film festival exactly, though?
This is Chicago, Josh. Where there's a will, there's a way.
Well, the 50th annual Chicago International Film Fest, never fixed by gamblers or Michael Phillips, for the record, kicks off October 9th. And this week on the show, Adam and I preview some of the festival's highlights.
And we'll remember festivals past with our top five Chicago Film Fest discoveries. That and more ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is supported by Varidesk, a height-adjustable standing desk that sits on top of your existing furniture and allows you to raise from a seated to standing position in just 3 seconds. Varidesk ships fully assembled and is ready to use right out of the box. There are 4 models to choose from for single and dual monitors. Learn more at varidesk.com. That's V-A-R-I-desk.com.
We're also brought to you by audible.com, a leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/film. That's audiblepodcast.com/film. You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam Kempinar. I'm Josh Larson. The Chicago International Film Festival in this season of festivals right now, that one begins on October 9, coming up in just a few days here. They're going to feature over 180 films. Later in the show, we're going to look back at them at our Chicago International Film Festival discoveries, the pictures that stand out to us in our memory that we saw for the first time at a past fest and it pointed to a filmmaker we've gone on to really love or been one of those films that's just stuck with us. But first, we're going to look ahead a little bit to what's being offered at this year's festival. And you and I just did that. We came from a Critics Picks event that was held here in downtown Chicago by the festival. You were on a panel with the Dissolves, Tasha Robinson, and Matt Pace from Red Eye, making your picks for the fest and talking about those for the crowd that was gathered there. I thought it went pretty well.
Thank you.
I hope you appreciated my not heckling you at all jeering any of your picks.
I did very much. And I should say that I was very much out of my element having to come up with a top five list.
The structure was a challenge,
wasn't it? It was very difficult. But it was a fun event. I want to thank the Chicago Film Festival and the CIF Junior Board who put on that event. And as it turns out, Tasha stole a lot of my picks in terms of the movies I was most anticipating. We're going to get to the movies I did talk about because I did have a chance to see a lot of them. One of the beauties of film festivals these days is that press screenings don't have to just be screenings or DVD checkout anymore. You can watch them online, which may not be the best experience, but when you're trying to fit in a bunch of stuff and our
and
schedules...
And really hard to find stuff.
Exactly.
Also.
And schedules are as busy as ours are. It is very nice to have that luxury to be able to watch something at 10:30 or 11 o'clock at night when you have access to that link. So we're going to get to some of those in a minute. But Tasha highlighted some movies that I think for a lot of people who aren't just going to be going to this festival, but have been following other festivals recently and are looking ahead to some of the fall movies that are going to come out, some of those films that probably will only play in select theaters, but that most cinephiles are really anticipating. She had three of those picks, and I think it's only fair to start there, because if I was just making a list of the movies I'm most looking forward to seeing, there's no doubt, Josh, that The Look of Silence is my number one. That's the latest movie from Joshua Oppenheimer. Everyone knows he was a Golden Brick winner here on Film Spotting, of course, for The Act of Killing. And in keeping with my usual strategy here, I haven't been reading anything. I don't know a whole lot about it, but I know it really is a companion of sorts to The Act of Killing.
Yeah, I think that's the best way to describe it. Not a sequel, more a companion piece, looking at the victim side of that historical tragedy this time around, is my understanding. Mm-hmm. So that is definitely on my list as well. Another filmmaker that we've admired here on Film Spotting, Nuri Bilge Ceylan, who made Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, he is back with Winter Sleep, which was another one of Tasha's picks, would be one of my picks and yours as well, I'm sure. I think Anatolia was on both of our top 10 lists the year that came out. Is that
right?
Yeah,
in fact, in our top three.
Yep.
I think each of us had it that high. And I do look forward to the day, we've talked about this many times already, when we can both sit here and act like real film experts here, Josh, and claim to have seen more than one Ceylan film. Winter Sleep's going to be the second for us, unfortunately.
It will be my third. I don't want to put myself in the expert category, but I did see Climates.
You're holding out on me.
Yeah, no, I think I mentioned that
before.
You
were doing that in anticipation of one of our look back top five lists recently.
Climates, I saw for some reason when it came out in Chicago. Yeah, and I don't know, hadn't heard of him at all before, wasn't aware of his career, just happened to check it out and liked it. Anatolia for me was the big one, though. I mean, that was a huge step forward in my mind for him as a filmmaker, and now has me wanting to catch up with his other stuff as well.
So I'm the only neophyte here.
Well, you eventually, know, you brought it up. I didn't want to mention anything.
It's the role I have to play here, unfortunately, Josh. But we will hopefully at some point get to a Ceylan marathon. He's made somewhere between four and six features. I'm sorry I didn't look it up, so I may not get the count exactly right there, but enough for us to really dive into those films, and I think even see Anatolia again. But Winter Sleep was a movie that did win the Palme d'Or. It's 3 hours and 15 minutes long. Anatolia is a long film as well, but based on what I've seen of it, we showed a clip there at that Chicago Film Fest event. It looks just as visually stunning as Anatolia.
And to prove that I am a neophyte, it wasn't Climates that I saw. It was Distant.
Okay.
So I did see another Ceylan film.
Well, that makes
just
sense.
Just not the one I remembered.
That makes sense, because I joke that you've been holding out on us. Michael, of course, has talked about Climates here on the show many times.
That's
one of his favorite films
mind.
Of the past decade or so. And you never really chimed in. So that really is a lot clearer now with that, Josh. 2 Days, One Night is another film that Tasha highlighted. It's the latest film from the Dardenne brothers. So when you're going into these festivals, I think a lot of us, you look at plot descriptions or you look at directors, you look at actors and actresses, things that jump out to you. And you talk about, for us, Ceylan, now Oppenheimer, and you go to filmmakers like the Dardennes who have made great films, of course, like The Sun and La Promesse and L'Enfant and The Kid with the Bike.
Which we reviewed together here on the show. Very favorable.
Yeah, really liked. Some great films. This one stars a great actress, Marion Cotillard. So 2 Days, One Night, obviously one of those big films as well. We hope to catch up with at the festival. And one more I'll throw in, speaking of actresses who are as luminous as Marion Cotillard, Juliette Binoche in Olivier Assayas's film, The Clouds of Sils Maria.
Now, there's a filmmaker you are far more familiar with
than I am.
I'm
more familiar, yeah. I've actually seen almost all of his films, and I love Summer Hours. Irma Vep, of course, is great. I love Carlos. I love Something in the Air a few years ago. So Assayas is a filmmaker I really respect. You throw in Juliette Binoche. They work together on Summer Hours. And it's sort of a retelling of All About Eve, with Binoche playing an actress in that film. That really is all I need to know to be really fascinated by that film. So another big one that we haven't seen, but are looking forward to seeing here at the festival. And I will mention one more pick of Tasha's, but this is one that I did get a chance to see just this past weekend. It's a film from Italy by director Paolo Verzi called Human Capital. And there's some talk about this movie being the one that Italy is putting up for the Best Foreign Language Film Oscar. And the Chicago Film Fest guide describes it in its first sentence as Amores Perros Italian style. And I hadn't read that when I sent to you. It's basically Amores Perros. I mean, it's similar in that vein where it's kind of three chapters, but it focuses on the upper class exclusively in Italy. And it's right around the time, though it really doesn't make a whole lot of being a recent period piece. It nevertheless is a few years ago, or it seems very clearly it's supposed to be a few years ago, when not only the U.S. economy was crashing, but the world economy was crashing. And one of the key figures in this movie is someone who has hedged a lot of money on the fact that the Italian economy is probably going to fail, which would actually be good for him. But it's one of those movies, again, like Amores Perros, where there's one central event, and then we get three different chapters, three different perspectives that fill in some of the blanks in the backstory. Not so much give us perspective on what really happened. That does come into focus, and there is some truth revealed actually at the end of this movie. But we do see those different perspectives, and it's a movie that I did really enjoy and highly recommend. That's Human Capital, again, playing at the Chicago Film Fest. So probably a good transition for us, Josh, to get into some of the movies we did get a chance to see via screener and can recommend or not recommend if you're in the Chicago area and looking at films you want to see, or again, just eyeing potential movies that you want on your radar when they do come out on DVD or in a theater near you. What's one of the movies that you were able to check out?
So Gonzales is a film from Mexico that also is concerned with the global economy and the fallout of the recession in particular. That's one of the threads it's interested in, probably the thread that it handles a bit more strongly than this other thread that comes into play, which is a job that the main character, Gonzales, played by Harold Torres, takes because he really can't find anything else. And this job is in the call center of a megachurch in Mexico City that is led by a televangelist who's played by Carlos Bardem. And right away, we understand that this whole operation is a scam. If maybe there was a little more gray in that storyline, it might have held some more interest. But as soon as Gonzales walks into this place, he doesn't even go into the sanctuary. He goes past and is led right up to this call center, which is engineered for soliciting donations from the desperate people who call in with personal problems, all sorts of issues. And these phone bank tellers are trained to express the platitudes that the people want to hear and then end with a call for money. And it works. They're just raking in money at this place. And so this ties into the economy in the sense that Gonzales eventually comes to be revealed as one of these desperate people too. He has this TV that he absolutely adores in his apartment. He covers it every day when he leaves, but we find out he can't pay for it. And the credit card company is charging him quadruple for it. He has other loans, outstanding loans that he has to pay. Even his mother calls him on his phone every once in a while asking for him to send money. So this guy is just oppressed with demands from creditors around him. And the movie handles that well. It does a good job of doing it visually, of setting Gonzales apart from the rest of society. The director here is Christian Diaz-Pardo. Very widescreen cinematography, so that Gonzales is often in one corner and whatever other element of humanity is on the screen is far away from him. There's a couple kissing on the subway in one scene. Frequently, he'll walk out of his apartment complex and there's a group playing soccer. He's always separate from them. In fact, when the ball comes rolling his way, he just ignores it. But the movie does overplay this to some degree, where we don't see his face very often. He's in shadow or in darkness. And Torres, in the lead performance, really goes for this blank and it's almost stubbornly reticent, the performance. It's really hard to access this guy. And that's clearly the point. But
and that can be fascinating sometimes. It can
be fascinating. I can't say that entirely worked for me here. And then by the time the movie gets to its third act, it makes this twist where the character goes haywire the other way and we start to enter Taxi Driver territory a little bit. And again, I understand that he's boiling to the point, and when he understands his desperation, he does explode. But there's such a juxtaposition there that doesn't entirely work. Still, some amazing cinematography, really interesting themes being explored here. So if it does sound interesting to you for any of those reasons, I would say give it a try. The film is Gonzales.
Well, two, I can strongly recommend, and you'll never believe this, Josh, I'm going to recommend a movie about making movies.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's a
I'm
shocker.
Shocked.
But this is a French film from a director named Léa Fazer, and it's called Maestro. And the maestro in this case, the filmmaker we're watching, is inspired by Eric Rohmer. And the making of his last film, here the director's name is Cédric Rivière. So very clearly supposed to be a stand-in for Rohmer, and he's worshipped almost by the people who are working on his crew and in this cast. These young actors just can't wait to get a chance to work with him. And then you have our main character named Henri, who really barely knows him. And when he actually does get a break, because he's definitely struggling to this point and has an opportunity to audition for him, he doesn't follow the advice of his friend, who is also in the movie, and study up or really learn a whole lot about him and his work. He watches part of one movie and then basically just jumps into it because he doesn't really care. He isn't someone who really appreciates art or beauty on any level. And you kind of know then what's in store for him, hopefully, throughout the making of this movie, as they get out to this countryside and they stage this period piece, this costume period piece that's set out in the lovely French countryside. You know that he's going to go through some kind of transformation by the end of this film and be someone who is just a little bit more of an adult about the world around him and his work. And we do see that. But what I like about this film a lot, there's a couple things in addition to just sort of enjoying the intrigue of the making of a film and some of the key performances. But it's a movie that takes gradual steps. It's not a case where he meets this director who everybody loves and the director has such a profound effect on him that he'll clearly never go back to being the guy he was and he's now this lover of the arts and beauty. No, by the end of the film, he's someone who we see maybe heading in the right direction, and I think that's enough. And I like just the little subtle insights this movie has. I also like the fact, and the Rivière character says it at one point, I think it does kind of underline the film, but I don't think in a bad way for me. He says something about appreciating beauty, and I didn't write down the quote, Josh, but it's something along the lines of just appreciating something that's beautiful for its beauty. And what I realized in that moment when he said it is that the movie had been very slyly setting the table for that. I realized that I enjoyed just sitting there sometimes watching the screen, watching Rivière watch nature and being able to just take a moment to actually sit there and appreciate that. And he's a character who obviously does that. And I don't think most of us do that in our lives. And so you do see the movie place an emphasis on that. And I think, again, by the end of the film, you see a character who's just maybe started to appreciate the beauty in the world and in art just a little bit more. And if you love Day for Night, if you're a fan of Woody Allen films, there's a part in particular where the music comes in, it's kind of this jazz score, and you really feel like you're watching a Woody Allen movie in terms of some of the interaction and the comedy and the philosophizing about art. It's Truffaut by way of Woody Allen, you know, Day for Night, but mixed with the Woody Allen film. And I love Woody Allen and I love that Truffaut movie. So Maestro was a movie that really was right in my wheelhouse.
Yeah, when I saw that on the list of screeners available and read that it had those meta elements, I knew you'd be all over it. So
yeah,
I let
I'm
that one go.
Predictable, unfortunately. Another one I want to highlight is a movie called This Afternoon, and it's directed by a local Chicago filmmaker named Stephen Cohen. I know he's someone, Josh, you've actually interviewed before back when his movie The Wise Kids, which was, I think, his first feature film, 2012, and it played the festival circuit completely off my radar, but it played the festival circuit and did get some accolades. The New York Times, I believe, recommended it then. And he's a local Chicago filmmaker and film instructor, and he does these acting labs at Acting Studio Chicago, these cinema labs. And what they'll do in these labs, and I'm not fully up to speed on everything that Stephen Cohen teaches, but I know that they'll workshop and improv and do these ideas, and they'll have camera people and filmmakers along with Stephen Cohen on site watching everything. And by the end of these workshops, they make a film, and they made a film called Support that ended up being the inspiration for this movie, which is a feature, though runs only about 66 minutes. And the whole film centers around two people, a man and a woman, who meet at a therapy group for sex addiction. And one of the two kind of stumbles in by accident. And the guy is someone who is studying at seminary to be a youth minister. And the woman is someone who has a husband and a young child, but is dealing with some sexual issues and some issues really of just feeling estranged from her husband and probably a bit lonely, and is acting out on that. And they come together for an afternoon. It's one of those films that involves two people in one place for almost the entire time. But when the acting's this good and the writing's this good, that's all worth it. That's all I really need. And one of the things I love about Stephen Cohen, having now watched The Wise Kids and his other recent feature, Black Box, is he's a filmmaker who really, kind of like Todd Solondz, one of these guys who just dwells in these uncomfortable, awkward spaces. There are moments, multiple moments in all of his films, where I find myself wanting to look away or waiting for him to cut. And it's a good kind of discomfort, though. It's the kind of thing where I'm not reacting to something that's disturbing. I'm reacting to something that actually strikes me as a little bit too intimate, too vulnerable. And sometimes that can be disconcerting as a viewer to watch. But when I can have that feeling multiple times in a movie, that's a really good thing. And Solondz is a filmmaker I respect, but he's also one of those guys who I think can really push that provocation and can be trying to push your buttons sometimes. I don't think Stephen Cohen is interested in pushing buttons. I think he's interested in that intimacy and that honesty.
Yeah, it's good to see him being part of the festival. He's fostering some important conversations with his films, for sure.
He is, and the actors, Stephen Cefalu, Nikki Pierce, and Stephen Cohen, along with the producer Shane Simmons, are going to be at multiple screenings at the festival. So if you want to hear more about the film from their perspective, obviously you can get that with a Q&A, I'm guessing, that's going to follow those screenings. So big fan of this afternoon, and I do hope at some point down the road we can actually get Stephen Cohen on the show. I'd love to have him on to talk about his films, to talk about filmmaking, micro-budget filmmaking. This is a movie, again, not knowing the entire story, I can't say for sure what the budget was, but I saw the page. He had a GoFundMe or Indiegogo page that raised over $6,000 to make the movie. He was only asking for $5,000. He got, I think, over $6,000. It could have been made for that much. He said this is the lowest budget he's ever worked with. And I think this is the kind of movie that might be an inspiration for some young filmmakers out there wondering what they can do with $5,000. If they have Stephen Cohen's eye and his ear for writing, they can make something as good as This Afternoon, another one I recommend. That brings us to, I think, the last movie we're going to touch on. It's the only one we've both seen, and we both recommend it. It's a film from Spain called Artico.
I can highly, highly recommend it. This was a really fun experience because often with the Chicago International Film Festival, one of my priorities is to go after those recommendations Tasha made, which are the big filmmakers, an early chance to see their work, which might otherwise not come out for a couple of months. So Dardenne or Jalon, someone like that. In the case of Artico, here's a filmmaker. It was co-written and directed by Gabriel Velazquez. I knew nothing about, had never heard of.
Me
He's
too.
Made a number of films before in Spain, as you mentioned. So I sat down, went in blind, and was really blown away, actually, by this picture, which follows a handful of troubled teens in contemporary Spain. And what's remarkable about the movie is how it's composed essentially of two shots he really relies on. And one is a very wide screen, wide shot that features these kids as small figures, maybe in the foreground, maybe in the corner, and they're up to dealing drugs or stealing or something like that. But the surroundings they're doing this in are just gorgeous. It may be a park where one of the girls is selling drugs out of the baby buggy of the kid she's supposed to be babysitting. That's her cover. And the park is just beautiful. There's even a church steeple peeking above the trees in one shot. Or there are these rural scenes. A lot of it is set in the region of Salamanca. And just gorgeous rural scenes. But again, a house is being broken into or something like that. And I like the juxtaposition of that. In those shots, the kids are these pesky, almost bugs, you know, breaking up this idyll. But then we'll get an extreme close-up of one of these kids. There are four central figures, really, two boys and two girls. And they're teenagers, I would say, late teens, looking right at the camera, right at you. And we hear on the soundtrack their innermost thoughts, where they're confessing something or expressing some sort of frustration. This is tied into the global economy a little bit, too. One point, one of the girls mentions how her boyfriend can't get a legal job because of the recession. So that's an underlying, in addition to just the universal, timeless idea of youthful disaffection. There's how it plays out in this particular time mm-hmm. period. And I just found the juxtaposition, again, of the shots really remarkable. It almost reminded me of, speaking of J-Lon, it reminded me of some of the imagery he did in Anatolia,
for sure.
Also, Carlos Regadas, who made Post-Tenebras Lux, who really likes to juxtapose rural beauty or just natural beauty with human awfulness in a lot of ways, reminded me of that. It's as if those two filmmakers had made their version of Larry Clark's Kids in a way.
Huh.
And really just jumped out at me. I would highly recommend seeking this out.
Yeah, I can really recommend it as well. And going back to the discussion you and Michael Phillips had last week, where you brought up Soderbergh and his work with Raiders of the Lost Ark, stripped out the sound, the music anyway, and he made it black and white to really focus on the staging and the images. One of the things he says in his write-up for why he did that little experiment, he mentions how he's one of those believers in basically being able to watch movies with the sound off.
Mm.
A good movie is one you should be able to watch with the sound off.
You don't need the dialogue.
And that's something I'm sure both of us have used over the years when talking about certain films that we love. It is an ideal, I think, in some ways. It's a visual medium. If it can express whatever it needs to express with the camera, that's great. Of course, it's not something that most films can really pull off if it is a movie that's dialogue heavy, and that's okay too when movies have great writing. This is a film that you can honestly say to people, you could cut out the dialogue completely.
Sure.
And the director Velasquez pretty much does that. There aren't many lines in this film. It's a film that conveys everything in terms of mood, tone, emotion, psychology, just based on how shots look. And you said how gorgeous the shots are. They are, but there are a lot of them that are gorgeous but off in some way.
Mm.
There's an alienation to these characters, how they feel, I think, cut off from the rest of the world,
yep.
from the people around them, from their environment. And so when you're looking at a shot of a park and you see four trees, and you're right, the characters are often very small in that frame, but there's four trees and the green grass and you're seeing water behind them, something about it looks as natural as anything you've ever seen, while also looking like something out of a science fiction movie.
Mm-hmm.
The trees don't really look like trees. They're black vertical poles almost, you know, and the grass is so green and so vivid that it feels unreal. It feels supernatural in some ways. And so that camera is really all you need to pay attention to here. And one of the things that really struck me, and I don't want to use the word experiment because I don't know if the director was truly experimenting, and that also maybe limits the film a little bit in what it's trying to accomplish. But you talked about those two shots it relies on, the long shots where the figures are very small in the frame, and then these close-ups where the only real insight we get into some of these characters are these moments that are almost chapter breaks, where it shows us a character's face looking at us in close-up, and then some text on a screen that is a quote from them that we don't ever actually see them say.
No,
I don't believe.
They're not speaking as they're looking, right?
And I don't think we hear them say it at any point in the film either. That's just a moment that he takes out almost from their psyche and gives us on screen. Those are the only moments that give us any insight into their point of view. So the experimentation part is one where I don't remember the last film I saw where I felt like the filmmaker gave us characters without giving us any sense truly of their point of view, meaning not just what's going through their mind, but how we see the world. We don't see the world through the eyes of any of these characters. We never see what they're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
We never get close-ups of what's around them, them surveying their space. The camera is always this detached observer that is letting us take in this world. And so it is a funny thing to watch a movie where, other than those little breaks, you really have no sense of what these characters' motivations are, what they're after. So in that way, it does feel like an experiment, but a really worthy one, I think. It fascinated me watching it, and it is stunning to look at, and I think that alone is reason to seek it out here at the festival if you can see it on a big screen.
And as you're talking about some of those images being visually off, I should mention, too, that he uses architecture frequently in this film.
I'm glad you said that.
It's not just rural, although that's what comes to mind first. I think of particularly those steps outside the hospital where Debbie, one of the main characters, mm-hmm. goes where she's considering abortion after right. she gets pregnant. And she's leaving the hospital with her friend, and they go down these – they're almost like – I don't know if they're brutalist style or something, but the concrete just envelops the screen as these two figures walk down.
The concrete,
and
the glass.
Science fiction-y almost about that particular sequence.
I'm really glad you said that, because you threw out a bunch of references to other filmmakers and films it reminded you of. The key one for me is actually Antonioni, because even though he's a guy who often is focusing on the upper classes, there's still this same sense of alienation,
yes.
right? His films, we talk about them in terms of the alienation trilogy, and you watch movies like The Eclipse, and you see actresses like Monica Vitti in these spaces with the architecture in the frame and the way they're framed, giving you that sense of alienation. You're right that this is a movie, despite the fact that it's so rural, when we do get some cityscapes, I felt very much like I was watching one of those alienation films from Antonioni. I also felt a little bit like, in a few moments, when we occasionally see a factory, for example, and we do get that factory shot a couple times, I was flashing back. I was having horror flashbacks to our recent Blindspotting discussion of Eraserhead. Right? Some of the few shots we get of that factory outside of the world that that main character inhabits,
it's kind
that
of
apartment.
Snowing in one scene, too, and that gets back to all the stuff in the air in Eraserhead.
Exactly.
Yeah, I could
see
that.
Another very visual-driven film like Arctico is, or Arctic is the, I suppose, English translation
right.
of what that movie is.
If you're
is
looking
called.
It up online, it's almost more helpful to use that title.
Yeah,
actually,
I think you'll probably find a little bit more about it, though. I know we were both Googling for any kind of insights into how they shot the movie. That's what I was really curious about. And I know you were looking to see if it was a departure for him or not as a filmmaker. I, like you, know nothing about Gabriel Velasquez. And after seeing this movie, I read somewhere, I think maybe it was The Hollywood Reporter, that this is the third film in a trilogy he's made about family. Of course, now I really want to see those previous two films.
And I think it described it actually as a continuation, this film, Arctico, of the previous one directly with some of the same characters, same actors. So, yeah, definitely some work of his we'll have to track down after this.
Well, if we talk too fast, which we probably did, or we listed off too many movies for you to keep up with as you were scribbling there, we will list every film we just mentioned and recommended at filmspotting.net. You can find a link in the show notes for this episode. Of course, you can also learn more about the Chicago Film Fest and all the movies playing there by visiting chicagofilmfestival.com.
Coming up next, we'll play a little Massacre Theater. Then, just to prove there's no lingering animosity from that Dead Poets Society bonus content argument, Adam and I work together in peace and harmony on a joint list of our top five Chicago International Film Festival discoveries. Stay with us.
Oh, my darling, you are the restless sea. With your black heart raging over me. As the
quick interruption here, as we do want to get to a sponsor note, but we also want to highlight our feature artist this week. This is one of my choices. Don't confuse it with one of our producer Sam Van Halgren's choices, because he wouldn't like that. He's much too hipsterific to enjoy a band like the Gaslight Anthem as much as I do. I just can't get Sam on board with this band for some reason, Josh, but I'm a huge fan. This is a track, Sweet Morphine, from their new album, Get Hurt. Still growing on me. I wouldn't say it's the album to start with if you're going to go down the Gaslight Anthem rabbit hole. I'd go with the 59 Sound or American Slang, but I do like Get Hurt, and I do really like the track Sweet Morphine. They are currently on tour. They are coming to Chicago on October 16th. So in just a few weeks, they're going to play the Aragon Ballroom, which I have memories of seeing a show there many years ago. Drove from Iowa, drove from Grinnell College with my bandmates to see the Black Crowes.
Wow.
1990.
They inspired that level of fandom, huh?
We were big Black Crowes fans. And this was even like post, you know, Shake Your Money Maker, their big hits.
Yeah, they were either, if they were playing the Aragon, which isn't huge, they were either coming up or starting to fade.
They were starting to fade.
Okay.
This was for their Three Snakes and One Charm album. I still like that album. We drove to Chicago to the Aragon to see the Black Crowes.
My Aragon memory, first time I was there, Jesus Jones and Stereo MCs.
Love it.
So I don't know where that lands.
Listeners, what year was it? I bet you can guess just based on the fact that Josh went to see Jesus Jones.
I think so.
I'm going to say 93.
I think you're right on. Possibly 94.
Okay.
But there was a definite Jesus Jones era that did not last long.
Wow. But you liked him enough.
I was there.
To go to the concert.
I didn't drive 4 hours.
Yeah, that's
a good
point.
I drove like a half hour.
Bad enough. I'm thinking about going back to the Aragon, Josh, because as it turns out, I have failed miserably as a parent in so many ways. One of the key ways I failed is not really getting my kids into my music.
Okay.
And I've just failed in that regard.
Aren't
especially
you the guy who just said recently you forced them to listen to your music in the car?
Right.
And so maybe that's backfired.
They're oblivious to it, right? Okay. It's not working, no matter how hard I try to point it out. But the one band it's worked with, the Gaslight Anthem.
Oh, okay.
All of my kids like it when I turn on the Gaslight Anthem in the car. They sing along to the songs. They are into them, and I'm actually considering taking...
Family trip to the Aragon?
Well, I'm considering taking Holden, the oldest, who likes them the most, to his first ever rock concert at the Aragon on October 16th.
Okay.
What do you think?
Boy, do you want to be the dad with the kid there?
I don't know.
Is the question. But, you know,
I think I'm the college student driving in from Iowa, so.
I know. The last show we went to was Vampire Weekend, and we actually thought, we saw a fair amount of, like, junior high to high school kids there with their parents, mm-hmm. and we felt bad, like, maybe we should have taken them, because they do like Vampire Weekend.
Right.
But I don't know if I can be that guy yet. I'm not that old.
I don't know. I got a little bit more time.
Let me know how it goes.
To decide. One other quick thing I wanted to bring up, and this will follow on the heels of the Chicago Film Festival preview we just did and leading into our Chicago Film Fest discoveries here in a second. Earlier tonight at that Critics Picks event, you recall at the end, they picked out some random winners and handed out some raffle prizes. I think the last winner was a guy named Jeff Hazlett. And I heard that name, and
that
I sat
right
there, and I thought, Jeff Hazlett, why does that sound familiar? I think maybe that guy listens to Film Spotting. Sure enough, pulling some things from the mailbag for this episode 30 minutes later, and I come across an email from Jeff Hazlett, who did attend the event, and he says, a little backstory, every year I take a week off from work during the festival and try to see between 25 to 30 films.
Wow.
Saw 28 last year. It's my week to pretend to be a film critic. I pretend to be a film critic every week. I've seen some of my favorite films at the fest over the years, Holy Motors, Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, Certified Copy, One of the Dead, and so many others. And he highlights a bunch here that he's really anticipating. We talked about a few of them, Josh. What about some of the ones that Jeff talks about that we did not?
Okay, yeah, let's see here. He wants to mention In Order of Disappearance. That's from director Hans-Peter Moland. Says it's a violent, dark comedy starring Stellan Skarsgård as a snowplow driver seeking revenge, described as being Tarantino-esque.
I'm sold.
Force Majeure is another recommendation from director Ruben Östlund. He said he read great things about this from Cannes. And a couple of other titles he lists here. Buzzard, Corn Island, Black Coal Thin Ice, The World of Kanako, and Everything We Loved.
Thank you very much, Jeff, for those picks and the input. Jeff does add that he promises to attend the live taping of the 1,000th episode of Film Spotting, no matter who's getting married. So apparently had a little bit of a conflict. I guess that excuse will work.
He chose a wedding over the 500th live show?
You know, you got to do what you got to do, I guess.
That's not what a film critic would do.
No, Jeff. That's true. We are very pleased to be brought to you once again by Audible.com. They are a leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. They are, of course, great to listen to when you are driving, you're stuck in traffic, you're doing the things you do when you're listening to Film Spotting, you're cleaning the house, doing the laundry, designing graphics, maybe all of the above, you're at the gym, whatever. I have recently really gotten on board. I've been listening to audiobooks over the years off and on, Josh, but lately it's replaced some of my normal podcasts, actually. And one I do want to recommend, I've talked many times how I'm a huge fan of the movie All That Jazz from Bob Fosse. I recently made it through, in about 10 days, I made it through Sam Wasson's recent, I think it came out a couple of years ago, his biography of Fosse, just called Fosse. You're familiar with audiobooks. You know that some of them can be long or short or whatever. How long do you think the Fosse autobiography is?
You mentioned this before, but how many hours?
Yeah, how many hours?
So 10 days, 14 hours?
27.
Yikes.
It's 27. And when I was done with it, I actually, this is maybe overstating it a little bit, but I did almost feel like something had gone from my life. Because it had been so present in my life.
No, that's how books work.
Yeah.
Whether you're reading or listening to them. Though, how long do you think it would have taken you to read it?
Oh, well.
Years?
Years now. Yeah. I mean, trying to fit it in with everything right. else. But when you're in a car sure. as often as I am, or you're mowing the lawn. Well, actually, I can't really hear it when I mow the lawn. But there are a lot of activities where I can have those headphones on. And I really dove into Fosse. So if you're a fan at all, or maybe a fledgling fan, definitely recommend that audiobook.
To download that audiobook for free or another one of your choice, just go to audiblepodcast.com/film. That's audiblepodcast.com/film.
And Jeff Hazlett, I won't hold it against you too much that you didn't stop up and say hi after the event.
I was wondering if you made the connection later so you couldn't really track him down.
Yeah.
Oh, well, next time.
Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit is a bi-weekly podcast hosted by BuzzFeed's Allison Wilmore and Matt Singer of The Dissolve, focusing on the world of online movies.
More information at filmspottingsvu.com or subscribe to the show on iTunes.
Hey there, listeners over at the Film Spotting Mothership. This is Allison Wilmore from the Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit podcast. And on our latest episode, while the rest of humanity may have doubted us and called us foolish, but we knew we had no choice but to answer to a higher calling, that being everyone in our listeners' choice poll who voted for us to review Darren Aronofsky's Noah.
And inspired by Noah's fantastical take on the Old Testament, we'll recommend some other films that, loosely or otherwise, are based on the Bible that are all available to rent or stream from home right now. To listen to the podcast, you can subscribe in iTunes or check us out at filmspottingsvu.com.
This is Colin Trevorrow, the director of Safety Not Guaranteed, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
If it's a quiet night out at the beach and your ex-old lady suddenly out of nowhere shows up with a story about her current billionaire land developer boyfriend and his wife and her boyfriend and a plot to kidnap the billionaire and throw him in a loony bin.
I need your help, Doc.
Maybe you should just look the other way.
Warning, you just listened to the first 20 seconds of the brand new trailer for Inherent Vice, the latest film from Paul Thomas Anderson. Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh. I'm Adam. We did want to take a second to acknowledge the big news coming out of the New York Film Festival, which kicked off last weekend. It runs through the 12th of the month, Josh. PTA's latest is going to have its premiere this weekend. If you're in the area, you can go ahead and check. I'm going to go out on a limb and say it's probably sold out. The trailer, though, did just hit the internet a few days ago as of this recording, and the production has been under wraps and very quiet and clandestine this whole time. So seeing something on screen was a big deal, obviously, and it should be. It's the latest from Paul Thomas Anderson. So far from what I've seen, it's been rapturously received, but we can't comment on it because we've avoided it.
Yeah, I don't really want to watch this one, but really, wouldn't the big news be if the trailer came out and everyone said, oh, this looks awful?
Right.
I mean, what did you expect?
Yeah.
Right?
I do sort of feel like I didn't do the work I should for this episode, though. Yes, I hate trailers and I try to avoid them, but I know I'm eventually going to get stuck watching this trailer. There's just no doubt I'm going to go see 17 films between now and the time it comes out, and Inherent Vice is going to play before it, and I'm not going to close my eyes, so I probably should have just broken down and watched it, but I'm holding out still.
Did you watch any of the footage they released in advance of The Master? Remember, didn't they do something where there were more extended scenes or...
That sounds right, but no, I didn't.
Okay, you didn't watch. I saw some of that and didn't ruin my experience.
Okay, well, for now, we're holding strong and not watching any of the trailer, though most everybody who's listening to this right now probably did check it out. You can go ahead and let us know what you think of it. Feedback@filmspotting.net. The earlier buzz out of the New York Film Fest was the opening night premiere of David Fincher's latest Gone Girl. Stars Ben Affleck, Rosamund Pike. Another one I'm trying to avoid anything about, though, of course, we both follow a lot of film critics on Twitter, and we saw our streams fill up with comments after that premiere. I'm told, and it seems, that the response overall was pretty positive. And you've already seen it, right, Josh? You did catch up with this movie?
Saw it just yesterday.
Yes or no, that's all you can say.
Well,
don't ruin it for me.
You know what? I will say, yeah, because you haven't read the book either, right? I'm sure of that.
Did you?
No, I didn't.
Okay, come on. Because you do have a tendency to do that.
I do have that tendency. It was kind of fun, though, to go into a whodunit completely blank. In this case, I was glad that I hadn't read the book. Yeah, all I'll say, it's going to be a good conversation. I mean, there is a ton to get into. We are also going to have to plan on spoiler bonus content.
Okay.
Because there's really no way, I don't know, what I'm trying to work around as I'm writing something up right now is how to get into the meat of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Without spoiling anything. Fortunately for the show, we can do it one way for show proper and
yeah.
really get into it in bonus content. I think we're just going to have to.
Okay. I look forward to that. And it is interesting. It reminds me of our recent discussion of The One I Love, where we did get
a
few
comments.
Little
bit.
We got a voicemail and at least one emailer who was sort of disappointed with our review proper because they didn't understand why we were being so coy with everything, and they thought there were some things that we probably could have gotten into. And I don't disagree with the fact that there were probably some things that are explored in the first 10 or 20 minutes of the movie that we could have said. But if you know you've got the bonus content to fall back on, and someone isn't going to be listening to the radio or the podcast and have to fast forward through that, you can just give them that extra file to listen to. That's something we're going to exploit.
Yeah.
And we're going to try to be as, I guess, vague and specific as possible.
And hopefully still interesting.
Hopefully keep it interesting and somewhat insightful. So we'll see how we navigate that next week with Gone Girl. And speaking of Gone Girl, you and Michael Phillips last week on the show did give Film Spotting listeners a pretty tough poll question to answer. Who is given the best performance in a David Fincher-directed film? There's a pretty decent battle going on there between Fincher's toughest character, I'm guessing that's Tyler Durden, and his weakest, no, not Brad Pitt as the old man slash baby in the Curious Case of Benjamin
Button. The man baby isn't getting pummeled in the poll?
I don't think so. But Jesse Eisenberg as Mark Zuckerberg, I think, is in close contention with Mr.
With
Durden.
With Tyler Durden. Now I'm picturing those two in the ring.
Why not? We'll get to the results of that poll on next week's show, so you still have time to vote now at filmspotting.net. Also at our site, we're going to give away some passes to see Gone Girl, Josh, during its run here in Chicago. We
Very
have 25 nice. Admit 2 passes to give away. So all the information about that giveaway at our website, again, filmspotting.net. A recent poll we had some fun with was the Martin Scorsese, Quentin Tarantino repertory theater.
Repertory deathmatch.
Deathmatch. Only on Film Spotting will you get that type of deathmatch. We wanted to know who you would pick as the director you would want to run a repertory theater. Whose vision, whose sense of cinema is more in line with yours? And that was inspired by news that Tarantino, of course, is taking over the programming at the New Beverly, which up to now he has owned for a few years, I think. The Beverly just announced its first run of Tarantino curated picks. October is going to have a double feature of some Paul Mazursky films.
All right, so we have some real-world data to work with
That's
here.
Right.
The double feature is Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, along with Bloom and Love. This is, of course, in tribute to Mazursky, who died this past June. That's going to be followed by 20th anniversary screenings of Pulp Fiction
Where'd
and
come
The
up
Professional
with that one?
For six straight nights. This is sort of more what I was expecting. Other highlights for the month are going to be a Robin Williams double feature. Here are the two films he picked, The Best of Times and Moscow on the Hudson, which was also directed by Mazursky.
I got to jump in here real quick because we did that entire Robin Williams tribute, and I never did get a chance to mention The Best of Times.
I don't think either of those films were mentioned, were they?
No, I don't think so. And I have a real soft spot, at least from growing up. I haven't watched it recently, but that Kurt Russell movie, I think I just like any movie Kurt Russell made in the 80s, pretty much.
Really?
I even like
Overboard.
You could
do no wrong?
Yeah, Overboard
say,
with Goldie Hawn.
I immediately had this image of him on a boat.
There you go.
And that was the movie I was thinking of.
True story. There's a moment in that film where Goldie Hawn yells off the boat to him because she told the story earlier about these Spanish lovers. She yells to him, Arturo. When I got into high school and I had to pick my Spanish name, I was Arturo.
Wow.
Because of Overboard.
Wow. What an inspiration.
Insights into the man I am.
You were the coolest kid in Spanish class for that, I am sure.
I really like The Best of Times, though. It's worth seeing.
All right. Also, among Tarantino's programming is going to be a Halloween all-night bill that's hosted by Tarantino's pal and collaborator, Eli Roth. There are going to be special guests there as well. We don't have titles for that yet, but I think you can guess where those might go, given Tarantino and Roth's participation.
Sure. Every night offers a double bill at least. Tickets are only $8. We have to give a hat tip to our friend Nathan Rabin from The Dissolve, who wrote recently about this.
So seeing this, do you feel better about your Tarantino vote over Scorsese? Or
I do.
Really?
I do, especially because Paul Mazursky is a blind spot for me completely.
And so, because there's a chance that Overboard might
Overboard
make a schedule
and the best
at
of
some
times.
Point.
Kurt Russell, that's our next marathon, Josh.
Oh, man.
With all of that, let's get to Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, we massacred this.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Stop it. You're ignorant.
They're coming for you, Barbara.
Stop it. You're acting like a child.
Look, they're coming for you. Look, there comes one of them now.
He'll hear you.
Here he comes now. I'm getting out of here.
That was Russell Striner as Johnny and Judith O'Day as Barbara.
There you go.
In 1968's The Night of the Living Dead. It was written by John and George Romero and directed by George Romero. We massacred that scene back on episode number 506. It was when we did our blind spotting review of David Lynch's Eraserhead. We also shared our top five David Lynch scenes for that show.
Pete Craig in Film Spotting East, Alexandria, Virginia writes, lots of connections to Eraserhead. Both are horror films. Both are first features of their respective directors, Romero and Lynch. Both are in black and white, and both were not initially successful, but later achieved cult status through airings at midnight shows and are now considered classics of the genre. I do think that's the only tie-in we were really going for there. Didn't even think about the debuts and some of the other stuff. But yes, in fact, cult classics. Josh's Karlovian reading of They're Coming to Get You, Barbara was a dead giveaway.
Oh,
nice play on words,
Pete.
It so immediately evoked the image of that opening scene in the cemetery and how badly things were about to go wrong that my hands started to shake. That's some acting that you're doing, Josh. Oh, and Adam's Barbara rendition immediately evoked the image of a low-paid, non-professional actor in a low-budget movie. Well done, Pete says. I think that's a backhanded compliment.
That's what you were going for.
Yeah, let's go with that.
You nailed it. Brad DeMoss from Sylmar, California said, a slightly more obscure connection between the two films is that George Romero got his start in Pittsburgh, while you mentioned that David Lynch was heavily influenced by his time spent in Philadelphia, also in the Keystone State.
Our listeners never let us down. To hear that episode, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, or you can listen at filmspotting.net. Not as many entries as our last Massacre Theater, which I'm totally drawing a blank on, but we thought would be fairly obvious.
And that one was a high point. Was it Beetlejuice?
Yeah, Beetlejuice.
Yeah.
And we had about double the entries we've been getting recently. Not quite up to Beetlejuice level, but yes, I think your performance did cue a lot of people into Night of the Living Dead. So reach into the brimming Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
The winner is Christopher Morang from Brooklyn, New York.
Congratulations, Christopher. I know he's been listening for at least 3 or 4 years. Email feedback at filmspotting.net to claim your very own Film Spotting t-shirt.
What do I know? I'm lucky to get the part. I know that. I come from Chicago. We do things a little differently out there. We do the play as written. That doesn't go over in New York. Terrific.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater. We'll give you the hint that it ties in with a topic or a person we're going to discuss in our top five list coming up
yet
here
to come
in just a little bit.
You haven't heard the clue yet. You
right.
will hear the clue.
That's correct. And I do feel compelled, Josh, to state off the top here before we get into the scene, really just to protect myself from our producer, Sam, who so loves to hear your funny voices, as we all do. I mean,
so insulting.
It's the highlight of
all
the show.
All that hard work and you call them funny voices.
Funny voices. Your accent work, it's so good.
Yeah, accent
but
work. I prefer that.
Accent work does sound a little more professional, I guess. You have actually decided that you're going to give this one up to me. I didn't ask for it. You're saying,
well, you did a little whining a few weeks back that you
well,
never get
you're right.
the juicy part.
You're right.
So
you remember.
Being generous and giving you this opportunity.
Oh, man.
Don't
but
blow
I'm just,
it.
I'm just going to drop the ball like it. I did with Bogey. And
oh, that was bad.
And if I do completely drop the ball again, and I haven't practiced this at all.
No,
we'll
you
go,
haven't, to
we'll
be fair.
Go back to 6 months of no accent work for Adam.
Just lady work.
Just lady work or straight man work.
Okay.
Is what I succeed at, apparently. So
let's give this a whirl.
You started off. I'm going to give you the action.
All right.
And action.
Hey, gasbag, stop it. Right now.
Or what? Are you threatening me? Because I think I can take you.
Excuse me?
You heard me.
I couldn't hear you from from all the way over there.
I can take you because you have one fatal flaw.
Oh, I want to hear it.
No, you don't. You can't take criticism.
Try me.
Can't take it.
What's my flaw?
Your temper. And scene. What do you think? Know.
That kind of sounded like lady work, too.
It did, didn't it?
The character is not female.
Yeah, I recognized that right away. I went up in the register a little bit, went to my Bono falsetto. And
oh, well, we gave you a shot.
I was trying to make it more difficult, maybe, is what I was going for. And you know what? Even with me getting the really juicy part there, getting the funny voice, you upstage me by nailing your part.
Hey, it's the accent
You just
work.
Nailed it.
Thank you.
He'd been setting you up for that role, apparently, because you really did pull that off. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. We'll pick the winner randomly from all the correct entries and announce it on the show in a couple of weeks. Your deadline is Monday, October 13th.
When we first met, I couldn't believe it. Pretty girl like you, going with a fat bloke like me, people were looking at us. I felt like the bee's knees. We ain't got much. We got each other. And that's enough, but if you don't want me, we ain't got nothing. We ain't a family.
The great British actor Timothy Spall there in 2002's All or Nothing from director Mike Lee. My introduction, not to Spall or Lee, but to the Chicago Film Festival. 2002 was the first year, Josh, where I was a Chicago resident, and I moved to Chicago in mid-September, just as the film festival was obviously starting to be promoted. It's always that first week in Chicago, first couple weeks in Chicago.
Jumped
and
right in.
I did. Coming from Iowa City, coming to a city like Chicago where a festival like that would play, and you saw all those movies and all those filmmakers and actors and actresses who were coming to town, it was something for the country kid from Iowa to come to the big city and see that festival. I was really excited about it. And even though I was, yes, familiar with Spall before All or Nothing, a movie I did really like at that festival, and familiar with Mike Lee's work, I know I'd studied some of his films actually in a British film class back at Iowa. There have been over the years some actors I've seen for the first time in Chicago Film Festival movies.
Okay.
So it's kind of appropriate as I'm going to touch on one or two of those that we're doing for this top five this week in honor of the upcoming Chicago International Film Festival in its 50th year. We're going to be looking at some discoveries of ours just in terms of films that we've caught up with over the past decade or so that are maybe movies we wouldn't have seen otherwise, or certainly not seen them on the big screen when we did, if it wasn't for a festival like the Chicago Film Festival. One of those discoveries for me as an actor, Channing Tatum. I go back to A Guide to Recognizing Your Saints, which I believe was the 2005 festival.
Mm-hmm.
First film I saw him in, I think maybe his screen debut, and I said, this kid's got something.
You were transfixed
by
the beefiness.
He's going to be a stripper someday. He's going to be a stripper. He's going to make a great movie with Soderbergh. I called it then. I'm sure it's on a blog somewhere. Also, the star, well, the co-star of our number five pick here. This is a movie I saw at that 2002 festival, and it's Roger Dodger from writer-director Dylan Kidd. His debut as a director. Campbell Scott is the lead in this movie, but it was the screen debut of Jesse Eisenberg. He is the nephew here to Campbell Scott's title character, a very cynical, jaded, macho ad executive in New York City. And this nephew from Ohio comes out for a weekend basically to lose his virginity. He thinks his Uncle Roger is going to help him accomplish that task. And what we get is Uncle Roger schooling him on the ways of women and life out on the streets of New York City over the course of about 24 hours. And this is a movie, Josh, that's actually been talked about quite a bit here on the show over the years. It was a movie that Sam and I, when film spotting and podcasting in general was just a gleam in our eye 3 years down the road, he was living here in Chicago at the time, and we went to see Roger Dodger just on Campbell Scott. It just sounded interesting. We liked him a lot as an actor from films like Big Night and Singles. And this is probably his best performance, certainly my favorite Campbell Scott performance in terms of his way with words, and there are many quotable lines.
Sex is everywhere, okay? It is all around us. It's not some distant destination. It's not Everest. It is right here. You have to attune yourself to it. You have to bring yourself into alignment. You have to find the zone, Nick, okay? Do that, and I promise you, a whole world will open up.
As it is a movie that's been talked about a fair amount over the years,
rather than dwelling on it any further. I just want to riff a little bit on Dylan Kidd, because here's a filmmaker who, if you look at his IMDb page, he made P.S. after Roger Dodger with Topher Grace and Laura Linney. An okay movie, not one for me that was really up to par with Roger Dodger. And then slated for a 2015 release is a movie called Get a Job that I wouldn't know anything about, except anyone who listened a few weeks ago to the Marc Maron WTF episode with Anna Kendrick. You know that Marc Maron actually did a bit part on this movie, Get a Job. And Anna Kendrick stars in it. And you know who else stars in it? Bryan Cranston, Miles Teller, Alison Brie. It's got this great cast. And both Mark and Anna Kendrick were basically saying, why isn't this movie coming out? Why does nobody care about this movie? Is it ever going to come out? They basically were saying they didn't know that anybody would ever see it. So that doesn't portend well.
No, it usually doesn't.
But I'm curious anyway, just based on Dylan Kidd.
Well, and how about the fact that there's, what, 11 years?
11 years.
Between those two
we
films.
We need to get to the bottom of the mystery of Dylan Kidd.
Sort of odd. I mean, yeah, P.S. I liked quite a bit. Not, you know, not something that stands out hugely. I think it was a great opportunity for Laura Linney in particular to get a showcase role at that time in her career. But yeah, boy, to be gone for a decade. Something's going on there.
Something's going on. He was a guest on Film Spotting a long time ago, one of the first ever filmmakers to appear on the show. Sam and I want to say around episode 100, did a look back at our favorite performances, period. It was a really dumb thing to do at that point in the show's infancy. But we looked at comedic performances, male and female, dramatic performances, male and female, and Dylan Kidd is pretty tight with, or at least at one time was pretty tight with, Ira Glass of This American Life fame.
Okay.
And as some longtime Film Spotting listeners know, our producer Sam once worked on This American Life. Sometimes you'd hear his name thanked at the end of an episode. So through Sam's connection to Ira, Ira got Dylan Kidd to actually record his picks for his favorite performances of all time. And that show is in our archives.
Well, you got to see if you can get Kidd's number again.
I know.
Find out what happened. All right, my number four, since this is a joint list, Discoveries from the Chicago International Film Festival. I'm going to go back to 2001 and choose The Devil's Backbone. This was my first real encounter with writer-director Guillermo del Toro. I was aware of Kronos by reputation, and I might have even seen Mimic. You'd think I'd remember a Mira Sorvino cockroach horror movie, but I'm not quite sure if I
There's been so many.
Had actually seen it. Nevertheless, The Devil's Backbone, it was my first true experience of him as an auteur, seeing that he's someone who has this unique sensibility that blends genre tropes and invasive fantasy in ways that few filmmakers have really ever done. The Devil's Backbone is a ghost story that's set in an orphanage. It takes place in the wake of the Spanish Civil War and follows a 12-year-old boy who gets sent there and ends up discovering some dark secrets about the place. There are so many simmering elements in this film. The boy with a reputation for tormenting other kids. This is a different character. There's a story about yet another boy who went missing. And then that diffused bomb that sits in the middle of the orphanage's courtyard. And it's just this potent, threatening symbol. Del Toro stirs all of this together, mixes it up, balances it perfectly so that it's something that's really, truly haunting. And I think in a lot of ways, especially its mixture of real world, war, and fantasy, it's a precursor of sorts for what might be Del Toro's best movie, Pan's Labyrinth. So Devil's Backbone was just a glimmer of that sort of thing to come from Del Toro back in 2001. I want to say I saw it at that point. They were holding the festival at the Landmark Century Center.
I am, of course, the president of the Pacific Rim chapter
of
the Guillermo del Toro fan club, so it really makes no sense at all that I've never seen The Devil's Backbone.
Well,
it's a movie I need to discover.
It's much, much better than Pacific Rim, so I don't know if you'd appreciate it.
So say you. But historical-based and a horror film, it does sound fascinating. I love a lot of what Guillermo del Toro does, of course, and it's a movie that I have really regretted for some time, though I have mentioned multiple times on the show how averse I am to scary movies. Is it going to scare me, Josh?
Oh, it'll creep you out.
Then I'm never going to watch it. I guess there goes that. Our next pick here at number three is a film I gave some praise to a few years ago on the show and earlier in this episode mentioned, of course, Olivier Assayas and his upcoming film, The Clouds of Sils Maria, with Juliette Binoche playing at this year's festival. A few years ago, 2012, the highlight of the festival for me was Something in the Air or Après May. I saw this in October 2012. It came out later in the calendar year 2013 theatrically and made my top five films of the year so far back in July of 2013. I don't know how it just missed my top 10. I'd have to go back and look at that list. It's a movie I really do love. It's a semi-autobiographical portrait of the artist as a young revolutionary, basically. And in this case, the artist in question, it's a veiled version of Assayas himself, coming of age post student riots in Paris, 1968, and really trying to come to terms with himself as a person who has larger beliefs that he wants to fight for. Does he want to be some kind of revolutionary? But he's balancing that against his artistic desires and his personal drive to be an artist. So that awakening is happening at the same time he's dealing with these other issues and also some romantic issues as well. And I think what's most fascinating about this movie for me is seeing kind of the birth of a young filmmaker. By the end of the film, we see that that's the path he's going on, and the struggle of someone trying to decide whether or not he needs to use that camera for some kind of change or for art itself. It makes me think actually a little bit of a movie we were discussing earlier playing at the festival this year, Maestro. And we talked about Romare and the surrogate for him in this film, talking about how you just have to appreciate beauty. There's a sense in this character, Gilles, that he's a young man who just feels that kind of passion and wants to make those kind of images, but again, is sort of wrestling with exactly what the role of a young artist is. So Something in the Air or Après May is one that, as I said, talked about a few times here over the past couple of years on the show, but I don't know many people, Josh, who have taken the time to catch up with it, and I hope more people do. Definitely one of my Chicago Film Fest discoveries.
All right, at number two, I have Uncle Boon Mee, who can recall his past lives. This was one of those films that I had been reading about in places like Film Comment, other festival reports, well before I finally had the chance to see it, which was at the 2010 Chicago International Film Festival. It's from Thai filmmaker Apichatpong Wirasatagun, who studied film at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, so it was nice to have his movie return to the city at the fest. It had already won the Palme d'Or at Cannes that year, but I'm okay with the Chicago Festival getting these late, quote unquote. Some people say it feels like leftovers, but hey, it gives Chicagoans a chance to see some of these pictures before they get a theatrical release months later, if they do at all. Sometimes they don't make it to the city. Uncle Boon Mee centers on an older man who's dying of kidney complications at his country home, which lies at the edge of the jungle. And we're told that the spirits of the forest can sense his sickness and are being drawn out into the human world. The natural setting here is so palpable that I had this film on my top five nature films list for episode 456. And I talked about there how the movie itself is just so lush, so languid. It seems to droop like a heavy jungle frond, just a real tactile sense to this picture. Now, among the spirits that we meet are his late wife, who has this slow apparition at the dinner table that's haunting and also a romantic gesture. We also see his long-lost son, I believe it is, who returns as this ape-like creature who has these violently red eyes. For me, this film was a total plunge into another culture. I mean, we do that to degrees at an international film fest where you see pictures from all over the world, but this was just a deep plunge, more so than probably any other foreign film I've experienced. It's so seeped in Thai religious beliefs, cultural practices, and history. And I don't have the context for all of that. I still don't, even after reading more about the film after I saw it. So there were a whole host of bewildering elements. I can't pretend to comprehend everything that the movie is about or is referencing, but really, despite that, and maybe in some way because of that disorientation, it was really an unforgettable experience.
Let the record show that you not only dropped the word frond, but you pronounced the full name of that filmmaker. You didn't go with his nickname. Joe.
No.
You could have just called
twice.
Him Joe.
Twice I did it.
They don't know that.
I know, but you called me out on it.
I did. We had to check it for the record. So let the master tape show that Josh actually correctly pronounced that very difficult name.
I'm not doing
twice.
It a third.
No, I won't force you. Our final pick here for Chicago Film Festival Discoveries is a movie that I saw at the festival in 2007. And of course, many people listening will know that 2007 was maybe the best year for cinema in the past 10, 15, 20 years.
Okay.
This is the year that gave us Once, There Will Be Blood, Zodiac, for me, Atonement, a little movie called No Country for Old Men.
Okay, now you're making your case.
Yeah, exactly. Well, It's also the year of The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, ooh, which was a top five movie of 2007 for me. This is based on the life of Jean-Dominique Bauby, who was the editor-in-chief of the French Elle magazine, and he suffers a stroke, and he awakes to find that his faculties are still there. His brain is completely still there. He's mentally aware, but he's physically paralyzed, and I think it's just an eyelid. His left eyelid, maybe, is the one thing that he can move, and over the course of the time in the hospital and working with the nurses there, one of them played by Marie-Josée Croce, who's just a great French actress who I discovered watching this film, they develop a communication system and do find a way to craft his memoir, which, just if you really think about it, is arguably one of the most stunning feats in human history, frankly, that book...
When you see what it takes.
Yeah, when you see what it takes, that book actually got made, and we get to see here how Julian Schnabel brings it to the screen. And Schnabel, of course, one of those filmmakers known for his work as an artist as well, and you see that painterly eye at work here. You get to see some of these creative flourishes as he's locked in, but he can still escape in thinking about his life. He can have these flights of fancy with his imagination, and Schnabel takes great care in portraying those imaginative scenes on screen. And I remember that I got to this screening in 2007, Josh, at, I think it was at the AMC River East, and I remember I showed up a little bit late, and it was a packed house, and I was stuck down in front. I was in the second row. Never a great place to see any movie, but in retrospect, I do actually kind of appreciate it, because this is a film that opens with him suffering that stroke, and then for the next 20 minutes or so, I think, we see the world from his perspective. Schnabel makes us be locked in as well, and we only see the world as if the camera is his eyes, and he's trying to come to terms with what he's seeing. And being in that second row, it heightened everything. It made all the camera movements a little bit jerkier, and everything was just a little bit more intense being that close. And I actually think it added to my experience overall of feeling what kind of horror Bubby must have felt in that moment. Can't come close to really experiencing it, of course, but did get some sense of it based on being that close and, of course, the way Schnabel uses the camera in the film.
Yeah, this is such a cinematic picture in the sense that usually films that capture extreme disability put a lot of the onus on the actor. So think of Daniel Day-Lewis in My Left Foot, something like that, where that is how we're going to empathize or experience what they are through the acting. And here, it's the camera. I mean, mm-hmm. Amalric is very good in the role.
Oh, yeah, Matthew Amalric, yeah.
But here is the camera doing that work in remarkable, crushing, claustrophobic, yet also enlightening, and in some of those fantasy sequences, very freeing ways.
Mm-hmm. Those are our top five Chicago Film Festival discoveries. Obviously, I've only been going to the fest since about 2002. Josh, as you said, the early 2000s, probably really coming
about
into the city
time.
And
yeah,
taking advantage of it here. If you're someone who goes back before that, we'd love to hear from you. Send us your discoveries, feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and @Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Highlight some of the movies opening here in Chicago and in select cities this weekend. At the Music Box, they're showing the documentary The Last Days in Vietnam, which is about The Last Days of Vietnam. I saw an interview with the filmmaker on The Daily Show, and the subject matter does really intrigue me. So that's one I hope to seek out. The Dog is a film that I recommended on Film Spotting episode 504 about a month ago. It's a doc about the man who inspired the Sidney Lumet film Dog Day Afternoon, specifically that Al Pacino role. And Men, Women, and Children, fresh from its premiere at the Toronto International Film Festival. Sam here has put in our notes, it's a disastrous premiere. This is Jason Reitman, the guy who made Juno and Up in the Air and Young Adult, more recently a movie that neither of us saw, but everybody hated, and even he said was a mistake, Labor Day, with Josh Brolin and Kate Winslet. Coming off that, Reitman has made this movie about families struggling to communicate in the internet age, men, women, and children. I did see some of those reactions coming out of TIFF, and it was rare to see one or two really praising it, not just saying it was okay, really praising it while everybody else was completely destroying it.
Yeah,
so
I
don't know what to think.
Saw the negative stuff, though. Michael Phillips talked about it briefly in his film festival report on the last show. He seemed mixed to positive on it, so we've got that too.
Out in wide release, Annabelle, a killer doll movie, which scares me just to read, frankly. Left Behind, another one that scares me to read, frankly. The Rapture Happened and God Chose Nicolas Cage to Stay Behind.
Gun to your head. You've got to see Annabelle or Left Behind.
Oh, don't do that. Is death an option?
Choose. 3, 2, 1.
Left Behind.
Okay, good choice.
I'm going Left Behind. Gone Girl. Yes, Gone Girl, the David Fincher adaptation of the Gillian Flynn bestseller. Is it Gillian or Gillian, Josh?
Michael Phillips told me Gillian.
Okay,
so
well, I'm sure
if that's
right.
Wrong, it's his fault.
He's very sophisticated. It does star Ben Affleck. Next week on the show, we'll review Gone Girl and our top five. We've got a couple different options here we haven't completely landed on yet, Josh. So if people have thoughts on Twitter, they want to send us some of their picks, whatever, we're open to recommendations. We're thinking maybe movie missives.
Yeah, creative suggestion from Sam.
Like letters,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Letters, statements, proclamations.
Yes, because a diary plays a crucial part, and there are some other notes that are clues.
There's also missing persons or missing person movies and domestic murder mysteries.
So, cheery topic.
Cheery topic, husbands and wives. You know, my wife does spend too much time watching Snapped, and that scares me. I should get her guest input
for you should.
This list.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Hogren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our music this week is from The Gaslight Anthem. More information is at thegaslightanthem.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is supported by the 50th Chicago International Film Festival and the Illinois Office of Tourism, dedicated to introducing audiences to new filmmakers, new stories, and new perspectives. Featuring more than 200 films from over 50 countries, the festival runs October 9th through 23rd at AMC River East 21. Tickets and film schedule are available at chicagofilmfestival.com. The Chicago International Film Festival, because everybody loves movies. Illinois, mile after magnificent mile.
Come on, he goes kind of high in it, doesn't he?
No, not at all.
He doesn't at all?
I don't think so.
Oh, God. I'm the worst.
I actually want to see on some sort of like vocal register
how high
where he is and where you are in pitch.
Okay, so